Cloud. Hey, everybody. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you're going to stick around a while tonight while we do all the bad things we have in store tonight. This may be the night where we get arrested here and our studio blown up, and the spot where it used to sit will be salted. All right, you think? We'll see. We'll see. A bulletin here. We just got a bulletin. The South Carolina priest who told his parishioners that if they voted for Barack Obama, they had to come in and ask for forgiveness from him. And in the meantime, they couldn't accept any of the church's sacraments. I guess that would have included extreme unction and the death rites, but certainly not. Communion, and I guess not baptism. None of it, because they had the audacity to vote for someone who believes in a woman's right to privacy. Well, there's an update on this from the Augusta Chronicle. It says a South Carolina priest told his parishioners he was too hasty when he wrote on the church's website that those who voted for Barack Obama should refrain from taking communion because of Mr. Obama's abortion rights stance. After getting a standing ovation from parishioners Saturday at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Greenville, the Reverend J. Scott Newman said he wrote the column in haste and would have explained his position better had he taken his time. The Reverend Newman said he wrote the column, quote, at the last moment and right at the deadline, end quote, and he regrets the attention it has drawn. He said all future comments should come from South Carolina's Roman Catholic Diocese in Charleston. So what? Is he saying, I am an arrogant little bastard who stepped way outside the boundaries of even the Catholic Church with my pronouncement? No, let me see here. No, he didn't say that. Am I an arrogant little son of a bitch who tried to condemn people to hell because they voted for Barack Obama? No, he doesn't say that. What does he say? He says he should have taken his time in explaining his position. Oh, okay. God. And this just in, Barack Obama's, this is according to the Associated Press, it's in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Barack Obama's incoming administration is unlikely to bring criminal charges against government officials who authorized or engaged in terror during the George W. Bush presidency. Obama, it says here, who has criticized the use of torture, is being urged by some constitutional scholars and human rights groups to investigate possible war crimes by the Bush administration. However, two Obama advisors say there's little, if any, chance that the incoming president's Justice Department will go after anyone involved in authorizing or carrying out interrogations that provoked worldwide outrage. Okay, well, that's the end of that chapter. In the current issue of Harper's Magazine, the case is made for the necessity of appointing a commission to investigate the crime. The only crime they need to investigate here is the crime of torture. And by they, I mean a commission with subpoena power to find out exactly what happened, because until such an investigation until such a commission has been constituted, and it should not be comprised of anybody from a political point of view. Until that happens, folks, we live in a cesspool. We can all pretend like, hey, it's gone now. George is gone now. It's all gone now. It's all gone now. But it's not, and it will not be gone until we the people clear the books on this horrendous chapter. We've had two attorney generals or two Justice Department officials, Gonzalez and you, and a couple other ones, but those are the two most prominent who wrote just an absolute flurry of pretend legal memos that gave the executive branch of this government the authority to order torture. And it's it has to be removed. This stain on the Constitution, this stain that's comprised of urine and feces and blood and vomit, it's all over the U.S. Constitution, dumped there not just by the people being tortured, but by the people who saw the Constitution of the United States, as Bush put it, just a goddamn piece of paper. I'm not sure what these two people who claim to speak for Barack Obama, what they're basing their statement. It's not categorical, but it's close to it. There's little, if any, chance at any pursuit. I mean, this is not Iran-Contra, as bad as that was. This is not Watergate, as bad as that was. This is the complete and total destruction. No wiggle room here. Complete and total destruction of the rule of law in this country and the effectiveness or the reality of the U.S. Constitution. If the Obama administration does not pursue this, then the Obama administration is condoning it. And if the Obama administration condones torture, then we're screwed. That's it. And for everybody who got all teary-eyed like I did on the news that Barack Obama had won the election, that becomes nothing but junk, garbage, trash. It should be kicked to the curb and forgotten about. That emotional moment. If Barack Obama, or anyone, it just so happens history has handed him the presidency at a time when there must be a commission of inquiry and investigation and resolution as to what happened. How did the United States become a country whose official policy is torture? If that doesn't happen, then I don't know how to put it. I don't know how to put it. We're doomed, condemned. Whatever moral authority that might rest somewhere in the documents of the United States are now inoperative. They're no longer functional. They don't mean anything. It's sad that it rests on Barack Obama's shoulders, but it does. It could be him. It could be Joe Smith. It could be Harriet Jones. It could be anybody. The next president of the United States must, if the integrity or the hoped-for integrity of the United States is ever to be reestablished, must appoint an independent, powerful commission of inquiry, an investigation, and if at some point a decision is made not to prosecute based on the evidence that is brought up, that's okay. That's all right. I'm not saying that these criminal sons of bitches need to be prosecuted and imprisoned, although in a world of justice, in a world of law, that's what would happen. No, just the record. The record has to be there that at least the United States investigated to find out how its documents, how its system became so corrupted, so polluted, and so Nazi-like, so Stalinesque, as to put us where we are now, right this moment. And once that inquiry is complete, and I'm not talking about the 9/11 garbage junk piece of ridiculousness that passed for a commission inquiry. I'm not talking about that. Oh, no, 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 no. Subpoena power. So when a Karl Rove says, no, I'm not going to testify, they can send marshals out to throw the son of a bitch in jail permanently until he decides to testify. Until that happens, this country is going nowhere.
But he ain't what he seems. You'll see him in your head on a TV screen. Hey, buddy, I'm warning you to turn it off. Oh, he's a ghost, he's a god, he's a man, he's a guru. You're one microscopic cog in his catastrophic plan, designed and directed by his red rat.
And your day screaming with Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
Twenty-one past the hour, Lord. I don't want to end the day screaming anymore, Kathy. I really don't. I don't want anyone to end the day screaming with me. I don't know. I don't know how to change the persona. I'm not sure how to change the persona of the program, but I don't want to end the day screaming anymore. I don't.
It's much too late for that.
Well, I had hoped that when the election was over, with the removal of the Bush crime family, that there might be a return to an attempt at normalcy, which would probably going to eat up the first 4 years of the 8 years that Obama will serve, unless someone attempts to assassinate him. But this rot now that Bush and Cheney and you and Gonzalez and the rest of these people, John, you, the rot, the filth, the pornography that they have dumped into our history. They have, they have so violently assaulted this country. Let's change the word from torture to child rape. Would the incoming Obama administration pass on investigating to what extent the Bush crime family had been involved in raping children, sexually assaulting children? Would the incoming Obama administration say, well, no, I don't think so. Look, you know, we got a lot of stuff to handle here. How about if the incoming Obama administration had been told, well, memos were written that sanctioned or permitted child rape? It is now official policy. If we think someone is acting in an actor, it doesn't have to be a major actor, just an actor in the war on terror, we seize their children and rape them repeatedly, especially the ones under seven, because they're the ones that scream the most. What would the Obama administration or the Smith administration or the Wyszynski administration, what would be the attitude knowing that we had spent the past 6 or 7 years, the highest levels of government authorizing child rape? What? Any reaction? The corruption, the staining, the destruction of this country is evidence right now, right this moment, in the fact that the Bush administration wrote itself a bunch of memos back and forth, saying that this act and that act allowed torture. It does not. There is no such thing as an authorization of torture. It is in violation of U.S. domestic law. It is in violation of international law. It's in violation of the laws of war. It's in violation of every single code that I can think of. And if these two spokespeople for the incoming Barack Obama administration are correct, that there is going to be nothing, then the Obama administration or the Smith administration, not to load this on Barack Obama, he just, like I said, by the fact that he ran and got elected, it puts it on him. And there's no cover here. There's nowhere he or any president subsequent to this Bush crime family can hide. There's no place to hide. This is not as horrifying as Iran-Contra was. And had Iran-Contra been investigated or commission appointed, not the Tower Commission that was appointed, that turned out to be just garbage, not that, but a real commission of inquiry conducted not by Democrats and Republicans, but by constitutional law authorities, by people who do not have a political dog in the fight, people who are seeking the truth for the purpose of ending this crime spree that the United States of America is now involved in. If that doesn't happen, then whatever claim to integrity or moral authority that we have or Barack Obama has goes into the nearest toilet with the rest of the stuff that goes into a toilet and gets flushed away. And then we all can accept the fact that we live in a criminal society, and that's the way it's going to remain.
Gently into that good night. Rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. So seriously, how do we exist as a nation of laws if the immediately preceding 6, 7, 8 years are not thoroughly investigated by a commission seeking truth and ultimately, hopefully, reconciliation? There doesn't necessarily need to be prosecutions, although if the truth were to come out, there are countries on this tired planet in which the fact that Bush and his criminal enterprise committed these crimes against humanity on Cuban soil, or our soil, I guess, since we own it or we have a lease on it, or wherever, all these people in the Bush crime family would be subject to international arrest and trial. Now, I don't think that any country would do that. And if they issued an arrest warrant, I don't think the United States would honor it and extradite these criminals. This has to be done here. It has to be done in the United States by United States Commission of Inquiry, by legal scholars who understand. Well, let me think. Constitutional scholar. Oh, I know one. He's soon to be president of the United States, isn't he? Isn't Barack Obama a constitutional scholar? Isn't that what he What he taught? I think it is. Wait a minute. Here's an email from Sandy. Mike, I wish people would stop referring to Obama as a constitutional scholar until he shows us that he actually is one. One of the issues that almost kept me from voting for Obama was his vote in support of the telecommunications company voluntary, illegal, and unconstitutional spying on the United States. His vote was not necessary for passage or failure of the FISA legislation, so it left me frustrated and baffled. His convoluted response was unsatisfying and unsatisfactory, in my opinion. Yes, the weight of the world rests on Obama's shoulders, and we must continue to press him on all constitutional issues that have been corrupted to the core by the Bush-Cheney crime family. I hear Lawrence Tribe is one of his key legal advisors, which is a plus, but the question is, will the Obama administration listen to the citizens of this country any more than the current cabal? I hope it's not a rhetorical question. Sandy, writing from Portland. It concerns me in that this I don't think this is one of those issues we can just flush unless we want to flush the Constitution with it and flush the idea that this is a nation of law and that justice somehow, some way, eventually is served in this country. It disappears if we don't have a commission of inquiry into the crimes that were committed. There is no question. I mean, Bush and Cheney and the rest of these filth have admitted, they've already admitted to the crime of authorizing, being complicit in, a co-conspirator of torture. This is an illegal act. And a commission of inquiry would be there to find the full story. How many of the Bush appointees have been ordered not to testify ever? Everybody from Harriet Myers to Karl Rove to just write down the list. They've all been ordered no testimony ever. This is like omerta in the mafia. Silence. An absolute vow of silence. And if you break it, somehow, some way, we will kill you. We will. If you go to prison, if you try to hide in a jungle somewhere in Tanzania, we will track you down and kill you. This is what omerta means. There is no such thing as you breaking, well, I mean, in the pure Sicilian form. You understand what I'm saying. But this is what the Bush crime family has imposed on its made members. Omerta, silence. A commission of inquiry given subpoena power and enforcement power, not just enforcement power. You will come and testify. You will testify under oath. If you do not, you'll go to prison. What happens if you refuse to testify before a grand jury? You are jailed for the term of the grand jury. Usually, isn't that usually what happens? A commission of inquiry that I am thinking about after having read this article in Harper's would probably take a couple of 3 years, maybe the better part of the first half of the Obama administration, the first 4 years, during which time, if people like Rove or you or Gonzalez refuse to testify, they can go to prison and stay there. I think this is more upsetting to me than the fact that the torturing actually occurred, is the fact that now that there is a chance to bring those people to justice who have done such a thing, if that chance is passed, it's just, we're not going to do it for whatever reason. And the only reason would be political. It doesn't have to be front and center. It doesn't have to be, it's got to be public. It cannot be a secret commission. It has to be public, like the Watergate hearings. It must be an ongoing commission to which the press can attend and report upon. But it doesn't have to be front and center. Front and center is the economy. Front and center is how we salvage this country on several levels from the damage done by the Bush crime family. So the Commission of Inquiry does not have to be the focus of the Obama administration. As a matter of fact, it shouldn't have anything to do with the Obama administration, except the fact that it would be the Obama administration that appoints the necessary or makes the necessary executive orders to constitute a commission. And then the Obama administration leaves. Just go about your business, President Obama. Let the commission do what the commission will do. And then the results posted. Remember what Kenneth Starr did with the results of the Clinton investigation? He dumped how many pages on the internet? That freaks like Sean Hannity and his listeners and Rush Limbaugh and his listeners could access and read and play with themselves, apparently, while they read it, because it was garbage. Same thing could be done here. Do the Commission of Inquiry into how the United States became a torture nation. Who is responsible? Who violated the law? Who is subject to criminal penalties? And then put it out there for the American people to see the conclusions 3-4 years from now. Put the conclusions out there. And if nothing happens, if at that point, whoever is president, be it Obama or whomever, if at that point the president wants to issue pardons, so be it. Well, okay. Just let me catch my breath on that one. God. I don't know if you saw the article in the Times today about Phil Graham. Oh, what a pisser this guy is, huh? This is a guy who arguably single-handedly, with the help of Bill Clinton, because Clinton had to sign the bill that allowed this horrendous economic train wreck to occur. The Times article today was titled, "A Deregulator Looks Back Unswayed." And as Jesse writes, I read that this morning, Jesse, over my morning coffee, and there's a picture of the Turtle Man standing there, Phil Graham, and I swear to God, there are very few pictures. He and Cheney and Gonzalez, especially when Gonzalez smirks, and John Yoo when he smirks, when I see pictures of these four especially, maybe David Addington. Yeah, David, let's put him in there. Fine. I could get violent. I just feel like, oh, my God. And so, you know, I want to smash things in my own house. When I just see pictures of these people, they're so vile. But there was Phil Graham. And as Jesse writes, an article titled blah, blah, blah gives the real damage caused by this group. The magic number is $62 trillion of bad paper throughout the world. $62 trillion. Now, here's the quote that Jesse's referring to. This is from today's Times. Increasingly, institutions were trading the derivatives instruments that Mr. Graham had helped escape the scrutiny of regulators. UBS was collecting hundreds of millions of dollars from credit default swaps. In 2001, a year after passage of the commodities law, the derivatives market insured about $900 billion worth of credit. By last year, the number had swelled to $62 trillion. $62 trillion worth of bad paper floating around the planet. Now, when we come back, I'll tell you what that number means. Stay with us.
Me for the blues. Another one return. I won't go getting tired of you. I won't.
Mike Malloy Show on Nova M Radio. Talk radio matters here.
Look at the state of the world that we live in, where no one gives a damn about the future of children. Just building a cash flow, making a bank account.
10 before the hour.
The truth, is that what the world's about?
Now, there is some information out that maybe Mark Benjamin, writing at Salon.com today, says that there's growing talk in Washington that Bush might be considering this unprecedented blanket pardon for people involved in torture. And according to Salon, advisors to Barack Obama are pressing ahead with plans for a nonpartisan commission to investigate alleged abuses under Bush. Now, to what extent the pardon precludes any sort of criminal sanctions against anyone who might be found guilty of torture, I'm not sure. I think a pardon is a pardon. That's it. Everybody's home free. But again, it's almost essential, isn't it, that the American public understand what has happened so that it can't be done again. Barack Obama said Sunday night on 60 Minutes that the United States will not be a nation that tortures, and that he will be closing Guantanamo, and that torture, I'm paraphrasing now, but as torture perpetrated under Bush is going to cease. He didn't say that. Nobody in government wants to just stand out and make a statement like that, which is astonishing to me, but okay, I guess that's the way the game is played. So let's hope. But I digress. I digress. The article in the Times, a deregulator looks back unswayed about Phil Graham. $62 trillion worth of bad paper now is floating around the planet. That's according to the article in the New York Times. $62 trillion. Good God. According to Jesse, who wrote to me, that number represents an amount that is larger than the entire 2008 gross domestic product of the entire world by $2 trillion. So until that amount is reckoned with or satisfied, how is anybody's economy going to recover? Not just the United States, but anybody's. If the credit markets and the financial markets are flooded with $62 trillion, I can't even conceive of that. I can't conceive of $1 trillion. $62 trillion worth of bad paper. Maybe our economics correspondent or our business, what is Prairie 2? Is he's our economic, right? Maybe he can send me and fire off an email here to let me know what that means. But according to the New York Times, $62 trillion worth of in the derivatives market insured $62 trillion worth of paper in these credit default swaps, which I still don't, I have no earthly idea. Now, maybe the $62 trillion doesn't mean anything. Maybe it's just gibberish. You know, it's just what gibberishy people use when they talk to each other. Hey, gibberish, gibberish. Yeah, gibberish, gibberish, gibberish. $62 trillion. Yeah, gibberish, gibberish. You know, I have no idea. I don't know if it means anything. Maybe it doesn't. But the number is so huge. If it does mean something, hold on to your ass, because will anything have any value is what I'm trying to get to, I guess. I don't know. If everything is valueless because the system by which we assign value, how much is that house worth? $200,000. Oh, how much is that house worth? 200,000 durable bops. What's a durable bop? I have no idea. How do I get a durable bop? I don't know. Where did they come from? I don't know. You see, if that's the situation, if we have $62 trillion worth of bad paper floating around the planet, how do you get out of that? I don't know. I have no idea. But the article, if you haven't read it, you ought to go online, go to New York Times, nytimes.com. I guess you can access it if you're not a subscriber. I think you can. And read about Phil Graham, about he still is standing there giving the entire country the finger. He's the guy that years and years and years ago said he had no sympathy for poor people in this country because they're all fat. Huh? That was one of the milder things that this piece of human waste put out there for public consumption. Astonishing. Speaking of fat, you know, the West Virginia went for McCain 56% to 52% for Obama. 14% split there, which is one of the biggest in the country after this election. And now there's Centers for Disease Control has come out with a study. The most unhealthy state in America is West Virginia. It also has a 19%, almost 20% poverty rate. But Huntington, West Virginia is the city in the United States that is the least healthy, according to the CDC. Nearly half the adults in Huntington, West Virginia's five-county metro area are obese, an astounding percentage, it says here, far bigger than the national average in a country with a well-known weight problem. Huntington, West Virginia leads and a half dozen other illness measures, too, including heart disease and diabetes. It's even tops in the percentage of people who have lost all their teeth. Elderly people, half of all, I don't know what elderly means, but half of all elderly people in Huntington, West Virginia have lost all of their teeth. Diabetes, heart disease, obesity, no teeth, and they smoke like crazy there, too. Smoke like, just like fiends. So, now the fact that it went from McCain by 56% to Obama's 42, I don't know, is there any tie in there? Probably not. Stick around. We have some more stuff to get out, and then we're going to take your phone calls. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Welcome back. It's 6:30 past the hour. I referred to Barack Obama as a constitutional scholar a moment ago. I didn't mean to use that term. He taught constitutional law, and Kathy in Green Bay points that out. He's never written any articles that have ever been peer-reviewed and published in law journals, so on and so forth. Jonathan Turley is a constitutional scholar. And Kathy names a couple more. Anyway, I misspoke. I didn't mean to suggest that Barack Obama, he taught that at university, but he was certainly not a constitutional scholar. Kate writes, I believe John Yoo is a professor of constitutional law at Berkeley, of all places. I think he desperately needs a taste of his own medicine, perhaps waterboarding with ink. Remember how the Republican trolls in Congress during the trial of Bill Clinton in the Senate, the trolls marched over from the House of Representatives across the Capitol Rotunda to the Senate side, and you practically could hear them chanting "Rule of Law, Rule of Law," and all of a sudden, there's no demand from the Republicans for any kind of accountability for what the Bush crime family has done. Anyway, one more thing. Prairie 2 writes in about the $62 trillion in bad paper that seems to be floating around the planet, which is $2 trillion more than the entire gross domestic product of everything, every surgery performed, every product made, every manhole cover forged, every banana sold, everything, you know, the gross domestic product, everything, every fine collected by a court anywhere on earth, all of it goes into the gross domestic product, and $62 trillion is about $2 trillion more than what the globe produces in any given year. Prairie 2 writes, typically you get out of that much debt by issuing new currency and starting over. Like any other banana republic, it effectively means the end of the United States as a global power. The question is, does this much money really exist? It could just be a 100-to-1 margin on all these unregulated derivative markets. We don't know because the Fed stopped publishing the M3, which is worldwide dollar supply, almost 3 years ago. We tinfoil hat types were predicting that that signaled the end game. When the Fed stopped publishing, the M3 was about $12 trillion then and increasing at an alarming rate. It will be up to Obama to deal with this without plunging us into the dark ages. Well, we're in great shape, aren't we? Pretty soon we're getting into the holiday season and all this will pass, truth seekers, except, of course, when you decide, well, I think I'll go spend some money on my fam. I think I'll go spend. Okay. This year we make presents. But then, that's not what the holiday should be about. Maybe this year, the commercialism that the right-wingers love, you know, you're supposed to say Merry Christmas when you go spend all your money. I just have to share this with you. There's a new combatant in the Christmas wars. You know, we're about to start. Any day now, Bill O'Reilly is going to start frothing at the mouth and screaming about how the leftists are stopping Christ from being in Christmas. You know it's going to happen. But there's a new... Here's something else for him to sink his gums into. In Washington, D.C. buses, starting this week, probably today, there are ads up, you know, the bus ads inside the buses. The ads say, why believe in God? Just be good for goodness sake. Now, the ads will be running through December. The American Humanist Association unveiled this holiday ad campaign last Tuesday. It's costing about $40,000. And in lifting lyrics from Santa Claus is Coming to Town, the American Humanist Association is wading into what has become this this annual debate over commercialism, religion in the public square, and the meaning of Christmas. Spokesman for the humanist group said, quote, we are trying to reach out, reach our audience, and sometimes in order to reach an audience, everybody has to hear you. Our reason for doing it during the holidays is there an awful lot of agnostics, atheists, and other types of non-theists who feel a little alone during the holidays because of its association with traditional religion. Stop. Come on. You're not trying to reach your agnostics, atheists, and other types of non-theists. You're punching the believers in the eye. You're sticking a pencil, all right, not a pencil, a Q-tip, right into their eyeball. Okay, I'm down for that. Let's do it. But let's not say, oh, well, we're trying to get our message out to other atheists, and if everybody has to hear the message, well, that's just the way it goes. Stop it! That's not what you're doing. The group defines humanism as, quote, a progressive philosophy of life that without theism affirms our responsibility to lead ethical lives of value to self and to humanity. End quote. Now, last month, the Brit equivalent, it's called the British Humanist Association, they caused a ruckus. They had a similar campaign on London buses, and their message was, there's probably no God, now stop worrying about it, enjoy your life. Ooh, that's really radical, huh? And in this article it says, in Washington, the humanist campaign comes as conservative Christian groups gear up their efforts to keep Christ in Christmas. Oh, my God. In the past 5 years, groups such as the American Family Association and the Catholic League have criticized or threatened boycotts of retailers who use generic holiday greetings. And about a month ago, the American Family Association started selling buttons that say, it's okay to say Merry Christmas. Selling them? Oh, Lord. And the fact that the humanists now have gotten into this marketplace of ideas has kind of pissed off a guy named Tim Wildman. I think his dad was the one who founded the American Family Association, but Tim Wildman said about the ad in the buses, it's a stupid ad. How do we define good if we don't believe in God? He really said that. God is, in his word, the Bible tells us what's good and bad and right and wrong. If we are each ourselves defining what's good, it's going to be a crazy world. Well, no, that's not really what humanists believe in. Jerkwad. Of course there are universal standards of, to use your term, good. You know, never mind, I'm not even going to get into it. But, also, last Tuesday, the Orlando, Florida-based Liberty Council, a conservative Christian legal group that has no more interest in liberty than the man on the moon, they launched its sixth annual Friend or Foe Christmas campaign. And Liberty Council has intervened in disputes over nativity scenes and government bans on Christmas decorations, among other things. Matthew Staver, this group's chairman and dean of the Liberty University School of Law, said, it's the ultimate Grinch to say there is no God at a time when millions of people around the world celebrate the birth of Christ. Certainly they have the right to believe what they want, but this is insulting. Don't you love it? Huh? You don't love it? Oh, okay. So, Merry Christmas. You know, I have no problem with Christmas celebrations at all. I love them. And I think the whole season is a lot of fun. I really do. If it's to celebrate the birth of the Prince of Peace, okay. I I think that's a wonderful idea. Too bad Christians don't believe that, huh?
But have a cup of cheer. Have a holly jolly Christmas. And when you walk down the street, say hello to friends you know and everyone you meet. Ho, ho, the mistletoe hung where you can see. Somebody waits for you, kiss her once for me. Have a holly jolly Christmas, and in case you didn't, oh, by golly,
the next best thing to an impeachment hearing, it's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
There'll be scary ghost stories and tales of the glory.
21 past the hour. Burl Ives, of course, an Academy Award winning actor, singer, songwriter, and a rat. Yeah, he was a complete rat. He was identified in the infamous 1950 pamphlet titled Red Channels. It's put together by some people in the entertainment business and a couple of FBI investigators. And Burl Ives was identified as an entertainer with supposed communist ties. And he was called as a witness before the House Un-American Activities Committee back in the early 50s. And he ratted out fellow folk singer Pete Seeger and others as possible communists. Now, once he cooperated with the House Un-American Activities Committee, that ended his blacklisting, and that allowed him to continue with his acting. But the people that he named were screwed. That was it. Now, years later, decades later, apparently, Burl Ives and Pete Seeger let it all go. I think this was back in the 90s at some point. I remember being surprised to hear that Pete Seeger had performed with Burl Ives in New York, I would imagine. Where else? And let bygones be bygones. But among other things, in addition to being a singer and a songwriter and an actor, Burl Ives was also a coward. Absolute coward. Which really upsets me, because every year, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, is that the one he's, yeah, that's the one, that's where that song is from, I think, isn't it? I think it is. And if it's on television this year, Molly will probably watch it, and I will not sit there and say, yes, but the man singing that song was a coward and a traitor. Nah. Boy, it never stops, does it, huh? It just never stops. Well, bad news here for the ultra wealthy. Goldman Sachs, UBS, that's the Swiss banking giant, UBS is, that on whose board of directors Phil Graham, I think he still sits. But UBS and Goldman Sachs have decided they are not going to pay their top executives the multi-million dollar bonuses this year because, not because they don't deserve it. Oh, heaven forbid. Not because they didn't earn it. How could you think of such a thing, Malloy? The reason these top executives will not be getting their multi-million dollar bonuses this year is because of public scrutiny of the kind of compensation these vermin actually get. According to New York Times, UBS said its chairman, its CEO, and other members of the executive board would receive only fixed salaries this year, and that all other employees would get lower 2008 bonuses. Now, UBS received a Swiss government bailout of $60 billion in October after the company lost $50 billion in the past year. But never mind, bonuses must be paid to the other employees. Now, this announcement came, Dea, did you see it in the New York Times the other day? The top executives at Goldman Sachs will not be receiving a bonus for their work in 2008. Now, UBS and Goldman Sachs saying, no bonuses, too much public scrutiny, Jesus Christ, go away. I mean, you've got millions, billions, so you have to pass up quiet. Now, that turns up the pressure on companies like Morgan Stanley, one of the Goldman Sachs and UBS's competitors, right? The chief executive of Deutsche Bank announced that he would forego his bonus this year as what he called a very personal sign of solidarity. Oh, God. So all this money that has been coming, I don't know where it's coming from. They say it's coming from taxpayers, these hundreds of billions of dollars that are going to shore up the criminals who have done what they've done to us. It continues to go in their pockets. You knew this. I knew this. We all knew this. This is the kind of thing that eventually brings about revolution. But for the time being, it made everybody go, oh, well, there's a solution. $700 billion will go to shore up the financial services industry. So then credit will flow again and we all can be happy little mice. No, that's not what happened. The first part happened, but the second part didn't. Now, Goldman Sachs, of course, is the company that's paid out some of the biggest bonuses in the history of predatory capitalism. For example, the company's CEO received a salary and bonus package last year worth $68 million. Oh, did you work your ass off for that? I'll bet you did, didn't you, Mr. Chairman or whatever you are. We'll be right back.
the way you do it. You play the guitar on MTV. That ain't working. That's the way you do it. Money for nothing and your chicks for free. Now that ain't working. That's the way you do it. Let me tell you.
Redefining Anger Management. It's Mike Malloy, only on Nova M Radio.
Yeah, I just, I've had enough of the rage and the anger. You know what I'm saying? What was it, 6-8 months ago, I was talking about rage fatigue, and then it just exponentially increased. Okay, the election is over, which may or may not mean anything really... profound for Americans. It certainly doesn't mean anything as far as liberals are concerned, except Bush and his thugs are gone. But when I start thinking about just let it all go, just kick back, you know, to hell with all this nonsense. Then Newt Gingrich shows up someplace. And this guy, you know, I see people outside of Georgia apparently don't understand how evil this little bastard is. I mean, he really is. This is a guy who did some stuff to women who became his ex-wives that is just, I don't know, beyond forgiveness. Is such a thing beyond forgiveness? I'm not a very forgiving person, so it's easy for me to say something is beyond forgiveness. But a lot of people say, no, Malloy, anything can be forgiven. But Gingrich did some stuff that was just vile. He also had a reputation of being an enormous hypocrite, especially around sexual matters. Gingrich would try to climb on a pile of rocks if he thought there was something in there that he might be able to get some satisfaction from. Just a real degenerate a pig, really. I'm serious. No finesse. There are stories, not apocryphal, they really happened, of Gingrich sitting in the parking lot of the U.S. House of Representatives, and a secretary who worked in the House walking by, not realizing she was walking by Gingrich's car, but seeing him, and, you know, inclined to go over and say hi until she realized that somebody was in the front seat with him, servicing him. Now, this is when he was married, God knows to who. While he was going after Clinton and Clinton's little girlfriend, Gingrich had a girlfriend that worked for an agricultural subcommittee in the U.S. House. He did. She was on the payroll. At least Monica was an unpaid intern, wasn't she? But Gingrich, and then Gingrich married her, which is his third or fourth marriage. I'm not sure which. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, that's his business. It's the hypocrisy. But Gingrich is kind of a closeted pervert. By that I mean he aberrant sexual things, like maybe animals or corpses or huge feathery things. I don't know. Maybe he likes to dress up in women's underwear. I've heard that too. Not that there's anything wrong with that. If it's your kick, it's your kick. It's when it comes out of his personal life and becomes something that he's going to crusade against, or he's going to display his hypocrisy by being, just diarrhea of the mouth about all the bad things about, oh, I don't know. How about all the bad things about, gay marriage?
I think when the left, when the radicals lost the vote in California, they are determined to impose their will on this country no matter what the popular opinion, no matter what the law of the land. You've watched them, for example, in Massachusetts, basically drive the Catholic Church out of running adoption services.
All right, hold up. Can't stop that. That's not the cut I want. Do we have the cut that I want? Because I want you to hear from the very beginning. This is on Bill O'Reilly's program on Fox. And he asked Newt Gingrich about Prop 8. Do we have that? Okay. Again, whatever somebody believes is their personal business. But when, you know, your personal belief starts to stick its ugly ingrown head into public policy to the detriment of people who are doing nothing but trying to live their lives, that's when, you know, a line should be drawn. All right, here is O'Reilly talking to Newt on his scum-sucking program a couple of days ago.
Look, I think there is a...
No, that's not it.
...gay and
no.
secular fascism in this country.
No, let's stop it. Stop it again, please.
...that will on the rest of...
Okay, all right. What happened was O'Reilly says, okay, now the culture war. I know you've been flying around the country and you're doing stuff. This is O'Reilly talking to Newt. In the last three or four days, this is really nasty stuff. I mean, you know, hyper. We're going to show you some of the video. This is O'Reilly talking. A woman getting a cross smashed out of her hand. We had a church in Michigan invaded by gay activists. We're going to show you the video on Monday of that. We have exclusively. We had a guy in Sacramento fired from his job. We had boycotts called on restaurants. I mean, it's getting out of control. Very few days after the election. How do you assess that?
Look, I think there is a gay and secular fascism in this country that wants to impose its will on the rest of us, is prepared to use violence, to use harassment. I think it is prepared to use the government if it can get control of it. I think that it is a very dangerous threat to anybody who believes in traditional religion. And I think if you believe in historic Christianity, you have to confront the fact. And Frank, for that matter, if you believe in the historic version of Islam or the historic version of Judaism, you have to confront the reality that these secular extremists are determined to impose on you acceptance of a series of values that are antithetical. They're the opposite
of what you're taught in Sunday school. Are you surprised
at
the speed of it? You figured that there'd be a 2-week breathing, you know, like,
no,
when?
I think when the left, when the radicals lost the vote in California, they are determined to impose their will on this country no matter what the popular opinion, no matter what the law of the land. You've watched them, for example, in Massachusetts, basically drive the Catholic Church out of running adoption services, drive Catholic hospitals out of offering any services, because they impose secular rules that are fundamentally sinful,
right,
from the standpoint, you know.
I
think we need a debate. Clista and I just did a YouTube video on the Capitol Visitor Center, where there's also an effort to take in God We Trust out of the Capitol Visitor
Center.
Okay,
we'll talk about
that
when we come back.
That's
how bad it is. Oh, God. Secular fascism? What does that mean? What does secular fascism mean? I can't get over how crazy right wingers really can be. Here's Gingrich talking about there is a gay fascism in this country that wants to impose its will on the rest of us. No, you dumb bastard. That's not what trying to get the right to get married, for gay folk to get married, that has nothing to do with fascism or secularism or any ism. It's not trying to impose its will on the rest of us. It's just people trying to get the same kind of benefits that you have, Newt. You serial son of a bitch. You're the one that's been married 3 or 4 times. You're the one that goes into a hospital room and tells your wife, who just got a cancer operation, that you want to discuss what the alimony payments are going to be. You punk. Yeah, it's very easy for me not to get angry anymore, right? And James Dobson says gay folk want to destroy the institution of marriage And if they have the right to marry, that will destroy marriage, and it will destroy the earth? This is lunacy. This is insanity. But when you have a couple of aging white pigs like O'Reilly and Newt Gingrich talking about gay, secular fascism in this country that the queers want to impose on everyone else, oh my God. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Oh, well. So, yeah, let me file this. If you really want to hear that, I'll put a link up at my website when the program's over tonight. Isn't this insane? I mean, is it not insane? Oh, God. Secular fascism. As opposed to what, Newt? Religious fascism? Newt, who fancies himself this great thinker, this idea man, oh, yeah, right, reveals so much about himself when he uses a term, secular fascism, doesn't he? Doesn't he just reveal volumes? All right, when we come back, a joint statement today came from McCain and Obama. And also the fact that the auto industry in this country looks like it's about to go belly up. And then we'll get to your phone calls eventually. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
We saw the Buddha in a bar downtown, talking politics and nuclear fission. We see him and he's all washed up.
Ready for Radical Talk Radio? Make mine Mike Malloy on Nova M.
10 before the hour. Okay, here it is. This is a joint statement after Obama and McCain met today. I saw some of the video prior to their, or subsequent to their meeting, whichever. And I just got the feeling that McCain didn't like the power differential there as he sat over on that side and Barack Obama sat over on this side. It was kind of like, oh, no. Now, McCain is, you know, he's military and he understands chain of command and it's get along, go along. You know, kiss who's ever asked you need to kiss in order to get what it is that you're supposed to be getting, if it's another stripe, if it's another star, whatever. But still, it was interesting to watch in a very critical way, McCain's body language today. Here's their statement. At this defining moment in history, we believe that Americans of all parties want and need their leaders to come together and change the bad habits of Washington. The bad habits? So that we can solve the common and urgent challenges of our time. It is in this spirit that we had a productive conversation today about the need to launch a new era of reform where we take on government waste and bitter partisanship in Washington in order to restore trust in government and bring back prosperity and opportunity for every hardworking American family. We hope to work together in the days and months ahead on critical challenges like solving our financial crisis, creating a new energy economy, and protecting our nation's security. And a partridge in a pear tree. Good God. Change the bad habits of Washington. I wonder who wrote this, because it really isn't bad habits, guys. It's criminal activity. God damn. I mean, invading another country and murdering 2-3 million people is not a bad habit. Smoking is a bad habit. Or picking your nose at the dinner table is a bad habit. This stuff is murder. It's illegal. They are treasonable crimes. They are major felonies. They are not bad habits. Oops. Calm down. So they say they had a productive conversation and they're going to take on government waste. Government waste. Does that mean you're going to reduce the expenditures in the War Department by 90%? Because 90% of it is waste. Is that what? No? Not talking about that. What are you talking about then? Are you talking about the children's health insurance program? I'm sure if you dig around in there, you can find maybe of the, I don't know how many children take advantage of that, but let's pick a number, 10 million. Maybe you can find 6 or 7 kids whose parents shouldn't be on the program. Is that what you mean by government waste? What are you talking about? Are you talking about no-bid contracts? Are you talking about the continuation of having, for example, energy companies forming U.S. energy policy? Are you talking about that? What kind of waste are you talking about? Oh, I know. This can only be one president at a time, so once everything is taken care of and the parties are over and January 21st rolls around, we'll know. And then their joint statement says they want to bring back prosperity and opportunity for every hardworking American family. Does neither Barack Obama nor John McCain not understand that every hardworking American family does not... is not enmeshed in prosperity, that a lot of hardworking American families are kind of holding on by their teeth? And what's up with the hardworking American family? How about just American family? How about working family? How about not working? I mean, there's a lot of families that aren't working because, here's a news flash for both of you, there are no jobs. Jesus Christ, what's wrong with these people? What's wrong with these people? Huh? Who was it today announced 50,000 jobs lopped off? Was it Citigroup, Kathy? 50,000 jobs. What about those families? What about all those families whose positions with Citigroup, even though Citigroup is nothing but a huge casino, all right, they're casino workers, but it doesn't matter. Hardworking families, they're going to bring back... They're going to bring back prosperity and opportunity for every hardworking American family. What about the families where the dad has post-traumatic stress disorder because he did 4 tours in Bush's murder zones, and the wife stays home to take care of the husband, and they've got 3 kids, and he's battling the VA for disability payments, and her job as a daycare attendant, has been suspended, well, for 2 reasons. First of all, she can't leave her husband. But secondly, the daycare center has said, well, we're going to have to let you go because nobody is coming by here anymore because all of our parents are being laid off, so they don't need daycare. Oops, sorry. There I go again. Oh, my. We hope to work together in the days and months ahead on critical challenges, like solving our financial crisis. Guys, it's not like a Rubik's Cube. You're not going to solve it. There is nothing there to solve. It's been utterly and absolutely destroyed. It's time to start over? No. And protecting our nation's security. Is there a threat to our nation's security? An external threat? Is someone going to fly over our cities and drop bombs? Don't we still have 8,000 nuclear warheads that are still targeted at just about every country on Earth? I don't know. This joint statement is a little weird. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
stick to the story in your eyes. It's been shining down upon you now. Realize. Listen to the tide slowly turning.
Welcome back. It's 7 past the hour. You know, in talking about Gingrich, he's off on a tear again with his little bloomers in a wad. This guy is just such dreck. I mean, he is such a weird, nasty little man. His whole life is just chock-a-block with that sort of stuff. But the thing that must be especially painful to Newt's mother, Newt has a half-sister, Candace, who is a lesbian. They share a mom. They have the same mom. Newt had a different father from Newt's father left the family and pretty much left him destitute. And Newt's mother remarried, and Candace was born. And Candace is a completely out lesbian woman. And Newt doesn't care. I mean, it's his own sister. And I don't think in the entire time that he was in the U.S. House, I don't think he ever voted in favor of any amendment or bill that benefited directly or indirectly, mostly indirectly, because the U.S. House or Senate does not. They do not vote in favor of gay rights, but he never voted for anything that even remotely could benefit gay folk. And his own sister happens to be gay. I don't know how these people, how do they do it? How do they breathe? How do they live? How do they, some things are just not meant for us common folk to understand. All right, from our economic correspondent, Prairie 2 writes, Mike, Merry Christmas. UPS is declining to give any seasonal forecast of the number of packages they expect to handle or numbers of seasonal hires they'll make, if any. The second biggest layoff ever was announced by Citigroup, which is dropping 53,000 jobs on top of the 23,000 jobs they dropped last month. Despite massive bailouts from the Fed and lately from the Treasury Department, on top of sovereign wealth fund money of about $20 billion they got last year. Citigroup. Prairie 2 goes on. Well, you could argue that having fewer predatory bankers running around loose is a good thing. It still means 75,000 Bob Cratchits will be out on the street, and it will probably put at least twice that many more people out of work who made their living providing everything these people needed. Still, it's not as bad as putting a couple of million auto workers on the street, since they actually make something. That means the jobs that their suppliers and their suppliers' suppliers and the workers who provide goods and service for all those people, and again, to those people, all of them will be unemployed. Estimates are that if that happens, it will snowball into 20 million unemployed in short order. Chapter 11 reorganization for the automakers is out of the question. Nobody's going to lend them money. It's already to the point where the bank won't lend you money to buy a U.S. car. They aren't going to lend GM money on Chapter 11, so then it's Chapter 7 liquidation, and the equipment is off to China, if even they'll buy it. It may just sit there and rust. And Toyota's not going to step up, like the knuckle-draggers keep chanting, because all those people are not going to be buying anything. What General Motors wants is chump change compared to what Citigroup has already gotten, and the bankers still have their hand out. The right wing is so hot to eliminate the UAW, they don't care if they have to end civilization to do it. Yeah, that I'm glad Prairie 2 pointed out at the very end. The people who want to destroy the unions see a golden opportunity here. You know, who can defend the auto industry? It is very difficult to defend the auto industry per se. If it were only the auto industry and didn't involve hundreds of thousands of workers. But it does involve hundreds of thousands, if not millions of workers who are directly and indirectly connected to the auto industry. But senators from southern states with factories owned by European car manufacturers and Asian car manufacturers, that's where the resistance to the bailout of U.S. automakers is coming from. Want some examples? Republicans, of course, Richard Shelby and Jeff Sessions of Alabama, James DeMint of South Carolina, These are three Republicans trying to derail plans by the Democrats, supported by Barack Obama, to provide at least $25 billion in loans to the three U.S. companies. Now, I'm not saying I agree with this at all. I'm just saying, isn't it funny that the most vocal, not funny, isn't it ironic, not ironic, isn't it just smack in your face that the most vocal resistance is coming from the South, from Southern senators, who already have foreign auto plants in their states, non-unionized, that provide, compared to UAW jobs, maybe one-third the wages and benefits, if the benefits are there. I don't even know anymore. There certainly are no more retirement benefits for these folks, for auto workers. Alabama has two assembly plants owned by Daimler, which used to own part of Chrysler. One operated by Honda Motor Company and the other by Hyundai Motor Company. The Munich, Germany-based Bayerische Motorenwerks AG employs about 4,500 people at a Spartanburg, South Carolina assembly plant. Yada, 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 yada. It just goes on and on. This porkish jerk who runs Georgia, Sonny Perdue, about a year ago, signed a deal with Hyundai to open a plant. I think it's Hyundai. And then their CEO was indicted in Korea on fraud and whatever. But I think it's still going to go through. And, of course, none of these plants are unionized. None of them organized labor. Barack Obama's made a promise to assist organized labor. But this is how the right-wingers figure they can destroy it. As Prairie 2 points out, if you have to bring down one, two, maybe three car companies in the United States in order to break the death grip of the UAW, then do it. Who cares? Who cares? I honestly hope Barack Obama understands what he's up against. I'm sure he does. According to Bloomberg, job losses would total 2.5 million if an automaker fails in 2009. One fails. That includes 1.4 million people in industries not directly tied to manufacturing. Now, that's according to a study a couple of weeks ago by the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's where the University of Michigan is. A collapse of General Motors would cost the government, federal government, $200 billion in aid to states and extended unemployment benefits. That's how much would have to be sent to workers, to unemployed workers. Senator John Cornyn of Texas, another Southern Republican, white man, said that he opposes the plan. Texas is home to assembly plants for GM and Toyota. But you see, Cornyn is anti-union because he's anti-worker. A hungry, underpaid worker is an alert worker. He will not vote. He'll stay home. And Cornyn and the rest of these bastards understand that. So, now, the people with a few brains, that is the, like Toyota's North American Manufacturing Unit, a spokesman for that unit, Mike Goss, an American, says, "We're worried about any of these big auto companies failing." He says, "We're worried. We're concerned about it. The vehicles we build in North America use about 75% local content, and much of that is coming from the same companies that supply the big three in Detroit." So if those companies go out of business, guess what will happen to Jeff Sessions and these other DeMint, Richard Shelby, and the rest of these pigs, these Republican pigs here in the South? Guess what will happen in their little world? Their factories will go down the pipes too. Has no one told them that? Michaels, who is U.S. Vice President of Media Relations for Toyota, said the failure of one or more of the U.S. automakers would be devastating, his word, devastating for the entire industry. And yet there sit these white, chuckle-headed Southern Republican senators saying, "Well, you know what, we don't care if they go down. We don't want to bail them out. We don't think that's a good idea."
go gently into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. I just wonder if the auto industry, the American auto industry, as currently constituted, should be saved. And I said this last week, that's hell coming from me because, you know, that's the industry I grew up honoring. You know, United Auto Workers, the car industry. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, for heaven's sake. The only reason the Beach Boys could sing about Little Deuce Coupe and 409 and Jan and Dean could sing their songs is because of what went on in Detroit, you know, back east. But the auto industry has absolutely refused, and they're horrors in Congress. The entire Michigan delegation, House and Senate. Don't talk to me about John Conyers walks on water. Where it concerns this issue, every single member of the Michigan delegation always did exactly what they were told to do by the auto industry, and the auto industry absolutely utterly refused to understand that they were digging their own grave, and they dug it. Going all the way back to the mid-70s when Carter pleaded with them, begged them to improve mileage standards. Oh, no. Oh, buddy, out of your mind. I mean, it took how many acts of Congress just to get catalytic converters to be included? Oh, well, that'll raise the price of a car to the point where the American public can't afford it. We can't do that. We can't change the mileage. We can't do this. We can't do that. We can do none of that. And so here they are, all three of them. Of course, Chrysler died a couple of years ago anyway. I don't know, you know, that's just a walking, oozing corpse. Chrysler should have been buried a long time ago. But there's Ford and General Motors. Just utterly refusing to act as responsible corporations. What's a responsible corporation? Well, if I have to explain it to you, it'd be a waste of time. Absolutely refusing. Decade after decade, the writing was on the wall. Everyone's telling them, hey, look, German cars, Swedish cars, the Japanese cars, Korean cars, for Christ's sake. They're doing all the things you said you couldn't do. And look what's happening to your industry. Oh, well, no, I'm sorry. We can't do it. So General Motors winds up being what? What are they? Number one, number two, number four, number five in terms of how much money they spend on health care, for Christ's sake? For not just their active employees, but for all their retirees? That's another reason Richard Shelby and Jeff Sessions and the rest of these right-wing monsters would like to see the companies go down. Because when they go down, if they file for bankruptcy, that means that everything's wiped out. I mean, all their agreements with their union contracts, employment benefits, everything right down the toilet, which frees up several hundred thousand people to get into the insurance market and struggle to try to find some way. Or the retire. It's just what it is. The Republicans are trying to destroy the country. You have any doubt about that? You don't, do you? Look at their record. So the car industry, the American automobile industry, what are you going to do, huh? You want to save them? When we come back after this break, we're going to take your phone calls. And if you would, you know, just in the course of what you have to say about whatever other topic you're calling in about, you know, just mention that. Should the auto industry be saved? I mean, they have given us all the finger for so long with their great big SUVs and their Hummers. And just insane stuff. Instead of wonderful design, hybrid cars. It could have been done, what, 30 years ago? No. Look how they resisted seat belts. Look how they resisted airbags. Look how they resisted just covering the exposed metal inside of the car's cockpit. All of that. No, no, we can't do that. We can't do that. Blah, 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 blah. Just generation after generation, practically. No, we can't do that. So here they are. It's not Toyota that's on the brink of bankruptcy. It's not a Daimler. It's not Volvo. It's not Hyundai. It's not Kia. Isn't that interesting? Oh, I know. There's lots of reasons why they are not and our people are. But this begging and whining, isn't this sad? The corporate honchos of the big three, so-called. Please give us money. Please give us money. We're too big to fail. Please give us money. How much is GM stock today? Huh? Oh, God. Okay, I'll tell you what. Your phone calls when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Technologies that will enable you to drive a plug-in hybrid battery.
Yeah, I've always wanted to do that. Me and Jeff Sessions down there in Alabama, we always wanted to drive a plug-in battery. All right, let's go to your phone call. Sean is calling from Vancouver, Washington, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for the opportunity to, again, rage against the flying monkey, right?
Sure.
Hey, I think there would be a good opportunity here for President Obama to incorporate into his green infrastructure New Deal-type program a revamp of the entire auto industry, and we could save the unions along the way.
Sure. That's what a really progressive, forward-thinking leader would do. Of course, there's not a whole lot that Obama can do. He can propose. It's up to the captains of industry and the Congress to bring anything to fruition. But, yeah, it's a great idea.
And, you know, I mean, I think there's still hope. I mean, all the neoliberals expected that he was automatically right out of the chute. He was going to name Larry Summers or someone like that to the Treasury Department. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a ray of light here. He's not doing that. I mean, maybe he's holding out for something a lot more progressive, you know?
Well, I hope that's the case. I said towards the end of the campaign, after I decided that I was not going to sit here and bitch and whine about, well, Barack Obama isn't a liberal, which he is not, that I would go ahead and get on the bandwagon and vote for him and, you know, talk up his candidacy. So I did that, and now what I'm hoping is that that Barack Obama will somehow figure out a way to be progressive or just a working-class Democrat. He's not going to be a liberal.
I think the power elite grossly miscalculated. They thought they're going to have like a South Africa type situation where you have like a political figurehead. You know, as wonderful it was that Nelson Mandela was president, he didn't really affect any major economic transformation. But I think they miscalculated with Obama. I think Obama isn't going to just be a political figurehead. I think he's really going to call for some economic transformation, and the auto industry and the labor unions could be a big part of that.
I hope that's the case. I really do. I not to satisfy any kind of yearning in my little aging heart, but because it's the right thing to do. And I think if anybody in our leadership is serious about saving this economy or saving this country or saving this planet or making that turn from what the Industrial Revolution started in the 1840s and has come to at this point. If anyone, I'm all for it. Please, I'll jump on the bandwagon. I hope you're right, Sean.
Did you see the cover of Time with the New Deal with Obama looking like FDR?
No, I saw a picture somewhere of Obama sitting back with the cigarette and the cigarette holder.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't think he's going to be that. But
there's an African American economist out there, a woman named Julianne Malveaux. She's a great progressive economist. You know, someone like that should at least get consideration for one of these top economic posts, in my opinion.
I hope that happens. Sean, thanks, man. Appreciate you checking in. Alan is calling from Miami, listening on WINC. Hey, Alan.
Hi. Well, I like what the last guy had to say about the automobile industry. Obviously, making it lean and green and all that. But one thing that hasn't been mentioned is that we really ought to make sure that we get shares in it. You're not putting money in. We own it. We own whatever we put into it.
And well, if the taxpayers are asked to bail it out, but in a normal society that is all about democratic socialism, that would be a given. But if you even mentioning the word socialism, even when you connect it to the word democratic, it just makes people lose their bowels and head for the toilets.
Well, let's just say we get shares of it. We don't, accommodate some of those people that we don't necessarily say that we're nationalizing the company, but to the degree that we're putting our money in, we have become shareholders, stockholders.
But that is nationalization because there's not going to be a vote. There's not going to be a referendum. It's going to be decided in a couple of committees in the U.S. House. I don't even know if it needs Senate approval. I guess it does. It's going to be decided at the government level. It's not going to be decided by you and me. So if
right.
It is decided at the government level, by definition, the auto industry has just been nationalized.
Well, not all of it. Whatever part of it they put up, they put in 30% of it's 30%. So it's not fully national.
Well, the auto companies are asking for a 100% bailout. They're saying, we die unless you give us money. Now, here's the sad part. The $25 billion that they are wink, wink, nudge, nudge asking for at the very beginning is bat squeeze. And I think everyone knows it. We already kicked in $700 billion to these predatory lending companies or financial companies, and look what happened. Nothing. Yeah. Nothing.
Naomi Klein calls it a stick-up, and I agree with her on
that.
Yeah,
there you go. That's good.
She's good on it.
I haven't read that yet. Somebody sent me a link to that, but
yeah,
maybe you did.
Could I make a comment on another quick
sure.
comment? Because what I originally got on the phone queue for was to talk about this narrative you mentioned about Gingrich and O'Reilly and all this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it should be enough to hear their words to know that this war, this culture war that's been going on for quite a while, is just starting to heat up again. Does anybody think it's going to disappear? And it's a battle for who controls the narrative. And one of the problems that I think we all have with what the Democrats have done for the last few years, in order to try and be nicey-nice and everything, they have not given us the narrative of what really goes on in our country, in our nation. We are suffering from having swept under the rug so many unthinkable, unspeakable problems, so that when the right turns up the heat and starts using this kind of narrative about what the left is going to do, Democrats are unprepared to turn around and say something else, say what it really is, because they've taught everybody that this nastiness doesn't really happen. We just have to hold hands and work together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
part of the narrative really has to be talking about that we are. There may be good people on all sides of the spectrum, but there are some very nasty people who are enemies of democracy. And if we don't understand that that's part of the narrative, that we're fighting a battle for the life of whatever is left of democracy in this country, how can this country possibly pull out of this mess if we don't understand that's what it is we're trying to do?
Yeah, Alan, that certainly makes sense to me. And thanks, Alan. I appreciate your comments, as always. Good point. The Democrats don't declare a state of national emergency about stuff that really does constitute a state of national emergency, whereas the Republicans will start screaming about the invasion of Normandy and how somehow that relates to Bill Clinton's penis when it comes out that he has been participating in some oral sex with his girlfriend. The Republicans do that. Bill Clinton's false perjury or perjury trap was the greatest crisis to hit this country since, oh my God, since what? Oh, we got to impeach him quick and try him in the Supreme. And yet when there are real problems, when the Democrats do not clearly, categorically articulate. I remember one time, not so long ago, they had a progressive radio conference in D.C. Randy's talked about this. She and I were the only two commercial, active radio talk show hosts that showed up. There were a few other people from non-commercial statements or this stations or this and that. It was really pathetic that the only two people represented the progressive broadcast community. When was that, Kathy? It was before Air America, 6-7 years ago. The only two people there with any credentials at all about having an audience were Randy and I. And we practically begged or shouted at people like Harry Reid, who was not the Senate leader then, Ted Kennedy, Nancy Pelosi, the whole list, Joe Biden. They all came to talk to us, and we just practically screamed at them, you have got to start articulating the fact, and you got to do it in sound bite, short sentences, that the Republicans are destroying the country. It's an emergency. Nah. Why listen to these two raving lefty talk show hosts? Right? Okay. That's cool. Thomas is calling from Portland, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Thomas.
Yes.
Hi. Hello?
Hello there.
Hey.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am fantastic. I'm just honored and floored to be on your show.
Well, the pleasure's all mine. Thomas, what's up?
Well, I was listening, and I think maybe that the track was a little off, and I'm listening to something from earlier, but you were talking a little bit about Obama not investigating the interrogators.
The torture, and, yeah.
The torture.
The people who authorized torture.
Right. And for one thing, I want to get it out there right now that I am 100% there with you. I do believe that the Bush crime family, as you put it, should definitely be brought to bear for all the things.
Hey, Thomas, hold on a second. I got to put you on hold for a minute because we got to do a break, and we'll come back right after the break and finish the call, Thomas. All right, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Never get a chance to shine.
Before the hour, thanks to our engineer Ian Huff, our podcast manager and technical advisor Ben Birch. Sharon Gordy is our military affairs correspondent. Bruce Enberg, our economic advisor. Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf are this program's ethical advisors. The executive producer is Catherine Bay. We were talking with Thomas at in Portland, listening on KPOJ. All right, where were we, Thomas?
Just talking a little bit about the torturers that everyone's hoping that Obama's going to go after.
Mm-hmm.
And the point I wanted to make was I was actually speaking with a whole bunch of different people about this today, either through friends or the course of my work, and everyone seems to have be of the opinion that within the transition period, Obama should be laying out a roadmap as to how everything's going to go down for the duration of his term. And what struck me as a little bit odd about this is when considering the insidious nature of George Bush and his cronies, it just seems to me like you don't want to play your hand a little too soon. I don't think that it would be a good idea, while Bush still has the ability to issue preemptive pardons, to be going about saying, you know, giving them a roadmap as to how about you're going to go about prosecuting them.
And well, I do agree with what you're saying, but I think we have to stipulate that the Bush crime family may be criminals, but they have that kind of astute awareness of the crimes they're committing and the possible consequences, and what they're counting on, that all criminals have, and what they're counting on is that it'll be business as usual, the same old, same old, the same thing that that Clinton did when he took over from Pappy Bush, and refused to investigate what happened, what really happened with Iran-Contras. So, I hope you're right. I hope there is some master narrative that will present itself when Obama is president. But Lord, I just I'm beginning to wonder.
Yeah. Well, it's easy to, especially after 8 years, it's definitely hard to lose the cynicism, I think. That's what I've been trying really hard to do myself. But I'm going to take it. I think I am going to take it on faith. I think I've seen Obama say some good things, and he's laid out a good roadmap so far. But I can understand when you're dealing with an opponent, and that's exactly what Bush is to this country, an opponent.
Right.
Like him, you just, I really don't think that playing every, you know, giving in and playing your hands right away, you know, just holding some trumps.
Yeah, I hope you're right, Thomas. I hope you're right. I hope that's exactly the way it turns out. Because if it doesn't turn out that way, then I think there's going to be an awful lot of people who put an awful lot on the line to make sure that Barack Obama was elected, who are going to be excruciatingly disappointed, don't you think? I know I'll certainly be one of those. David is calling from California, listening on Sirius. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening, Mike.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to talk about the Big Three thing.
Okay.
I'm a truck driver, and I haul a lot of freight for parts for Toyota, Hyundai, Mercedes, those people down in the south there. And I have to tell you, you know, even if GM was to go under, I don't think it's really going to impact those particular people too much, because all their parts come from Mexico anyway. I pick up all of the Mercedes and Toyota, all that stuff comes out from the border, and I take it up in Alabama, South Carolina, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've talked to a lot of those people down there, and they seem to make a pretty decent living down there, being non-union. Most of those guys are making, you know, $18 to $30 an hour versus the $30 to $70 an hour that GM employees seem to be making.
Right.
One quick point. This money that the government's thinking about giving to General Motors and to Ford and to Chrysler, it's my understanding that GM has to turn over $25 billion at the end of the year to the UAW just to take care of their medical
their
retirees and stuff.
Yeah, it's my. I'm not sure what the number is exactly, David, but I can remember reading several months ago that General Motors was going to provide some sort of funding so that UAW retirees could self-insure. All these retirees who spent 15, 30, 40, 50 years at General Motors, and on the basis of the retirement package, whatever that included, whether it included a pension or health insurance. I mean, the workers did it on good faith. Why should the companies be allowed to now, after having used the workers, created their cars, did their manufacturing, made their profits, why should they be allowed to walk away from an agreement that they made with the UAW all those years ago? You see what I'm saying?
No, I totally understand, and you're right. They shouldn't be able to walk away, but
they will.
But the company is broken, and you know, to say, oh, yeah, let the government put money in there, and let's, you know, who wants shares in a broken company? Something has to be done. And if the only way that they can fix it is to reorganize, and unfortunately, you know, people are going to be hurt, and I'm not for that. I'm a 30-year Teamster, so believe me, I believe in my union.
Right.
But you know, at some point it just it gets to the point where it's just not going to work anymore. And what are you going to do then? I say, you know, let them fix it the way that they need to fix it, either that through bankruptcy, through reorganization, or, you know, I'm not really in favor of a government bailout. I mean, it's not working with the banks. Who's next? Do we need to start bailing out the retailers, you know, the hospital? I mean, where does it end? You know what I mean?
I understand
that there's people out there that are going to be affected by this, but at the same time, you have to, you know, you have to, I hate to say it, but you have to let capitalism work. And if they're not making a better mousetrap, well, shame on them. They've had 30 years to do this ever since the first gas crisis that we had back in the 70s, and they still haven't fixed it. So
I hear you. And David, good call. Thanks. I appreciate the points you made. As far as letting capitalism work, I don't know that not bailing these auto companies out is an example of capitalism working. And we'll talk about that more some other time. Thanks, man. I'll see you tomorrow night, Truth Seeker. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.